From Intellijix, this is Intellijix True Crime. Today, three true cases, each one investigated, tried, and closed. Let's begin. It was a Tuesday morning in October of 1999 when a woman who had always been careful, always been smart about the people she let into her life, didn't answer her door. That alone might not have alarmed anyone. People oversleep. People leave early for work. But the people who knew Tanya Briggs knew that she was not the kind of woman who left things unresolved, who let a phone call go unanswered, who disappeared without a word. And so, when the silence stretched from morning into afternoon, the worry that had begun as a quiet murmur became something louder, something that could not be ignored. What investigators would find inside that home in the quiet residential neighborhoods of San Diego would set in motion a case that asked a question people have struggled to answer for as long as communities have existed. How well do we ever truly know the people living right next door? Tanya Briggs was, by every account gathered from the people who loved her, exactly the kind of person a neighborhood is built around. She was warm without being naive, generous without being a pushover, and she possessed that particular gift some people have of making everyone in a room feel genuinely seen. Friends interviewed by San Diego Union-Tribune reporters in the weeks following her death described a woman who organized neighborhood gatherings, who remembered birthdays, who would bring food to a sick friend without being asked and leave before she could be thanked. She worked hard. She loved her family, and she maintained a circle of friends she had curated with care, people she trusted, people she believed in. She was also, those same friends noted, perceptive. She had a quality that the people closest to her recognized as a kind of social intelligence, an ability to read the dynamics of a room, to sense when something was off, to notice when the story someone was telling didn't quite align with the one they had told before. In the weeks before October of 1999, that perceptiveness had led her to a discovery about someone in her social circle, a discovery that she apparently intended to act on. That someone was Ronald James Kipp. Kipp was, on the surface, everything his neighbors and mutual friends believed him to be: charming, confident, the kind of man who seemed to know everyone and made sure everyone felt good about knowing him. He and Tanya Briggs traveled in overlapping social worlds, sharing friends and acquaintances in the way people do in tight-knit suburban communities. He had cultivated a reputation, worked at it the way some people work at a career, and that reputation was important to him in ways that went beyond simple vanity. What Tanya Briggs had come to understand, according to prosecutors, was that significant portions of the life Ronald Kipp had presented to the world were fabricated. The specific nature of those lies, detailed across court documents and trial testimony, pointed to a man who had constructed an alternate version of himself for the people around him, a version that depended entirely on no one comparing notes too carefully, no one asking the questions that didn't have good answers. Tanya Briggs, prosecutors alleged, had begun asking exactly those questions. According to the case built by the San Diego County District Attorney's Office, Kipp became aware that Tanya planned to expose his deceptions to their mutual friends. The social unraveling that would follow the loss of standing, the questions, the unraveling of the persona he had so carefully assembled, apparently struck him as an existential threat. What happened next, prosecutors argued, was not impulsive. It was not a confrontation that spun out of control. It was, in the prosecution's framing, a decision. The timeline reconstructed by investigators placed Kipp in contact with Tanya Briggs in the period immediately before her death. Phone records, which would become a cornerstone of the investigation, documented communication between the two in the final days of Tanya's life. Those records, subpoenaed early in the investigation, told a story that witnesses on their own could only partially tell, a story of contact, of proximity, of a relationship that had recently become something other than neighborly. When Tanya's body was discovered at her home, the San Diego Police Department began the methodical work that serious homicide investigations require. Detectives canvassed the neighborhood, interviewed friends and family, and began building the kind of layered picture of a victim's final days that can take weeks to assemble properly. What emerged was a portrait of a woman who had been frightened, who had confided to at least one friend that she was worried about Ronald Kipp's reaction to what she intended to do, worried in that specific way that, in retrospect, carries a terrible weight. That friend's account became one of the significant moments in the investigation. The testimony, as it would later be presented at trial, described Tanya's state of mind in the days before her death, her awareness that Kipp would not receive her planned disclosure well, her belief, nonetheless, that the truth needed to be told. She was not a woman who backed down from what she believed was right. That quality, the quality that had made her such a valued friend, may also have put her directly in Ronald Kipp's path at the worst possible moment. Physical evidence collected from the crime scene and subjected to forensic analysis provided investigators with material links that phone records and witness accounts alone could not supply. The specific details of that forensic evidence were laid out across days of testimony during the trial, with prosecutors arguing that the evidence placed Kipp at the scene in a manner that could not be explained by the innocent social contact of neighbors. The defense, for its part, challenged the interpretation of that evidence, as defense attorneys in any serious criminal trial are obligated to do, but the jury would ultimately find the prosecution's argument more persuasive. What made this case particularly difficult, in the way that cases involving people who know each other always present difficulties, was the question of motive. A stranger commits violence for reasons that are terrible but comprehensible in a certain grim arithmetic. When the perpetrator is someone known to the victim, someone trusted, someone embedded in the same social fabric, the investigation must work harder to answer the question of why, and prosecutors must make a jury understand a psychology that most people find genuinely difficult to fathom. The San Diego County District Attorney's Office answered that challenge by building a portrait of Ronald Kipp that stood in deliberate contrast to the portrait his social circle had been given. Through witnesses who had known him in different contexts, through records that documented the discrepancies between the life he described and the life he had actually lived, prosecutors presented a man for whom reputation was not simply important, but was, in a meaningful sense, the architecture of his entire social existence. Strip away the carefully maintained image, the argument went, and what remained was someone who had demonstrated a willingness to deceive the people closest to him, and who, when that deception was threatened, allegedly demonstrated a willingness to do something far worse. The investigation moved with the particular deliberateness that characterized serious cases in the San Diego Police Department's homicide unit during this period. Detectives cross-referenced the phone records against witness accounts of Kipp's whereabouts in the hours surrounding Tanya's death. They examined his explanations for his activities during the relevant window of time, and they found those explanations, according to subsequent testimony, to be insufficient. The alibi Kipp offered did not withstand scrutiny, and the scrutiny detectives applied was considerable. By the time the district attorney's office filed charges against Ronald James Kipp for the first-degree murder of Tanya Briggs, investigators had assembled what they believed was a case built on multiple, mutually reinforcing pillars. No single piece of evidence, no single witness, would carry the entire weight of the prosecution's argument. Instead, the case was designed the way the most durable prosecutions often are, as an interlocking structure, in which the removal of any one piece would leave the others still standing. The trial of Ronald James Kipp began in 2001, in a San Diego County courtroom, before a jury that would spend weeks absorbing testimony from investigators, forensic experts, and the friends and family whose lives had been altered permanently by what happened to Tanya Briggs. The proceedings attracted significant coverage from the San Diego Union-Tribune, whose reporters documented the testimony and the atmosphere of a trial that the community around Tanya Briggs had been waiting for. The prosecution's opening argument framed the case in exactly the terms investigators had constructed it: a premeditated act carried out by a man who believed his carefully constructed life was about to be dismantled, and who made a choice that no amount of social charm or careful image management could ultimately conceal. Prosecutors walked the jury through the phone records, through the forensic evidence, through the testimony of the friend to whom Tanya had confided her fears, through the inconsistencies in Kip's account of his own movements. The defense challenged each pillar in turn. Defense attorneys argued that the physical evidence was susceptible to interpretations other than the prosecution's, that witness accounts of Tanya's state of mind were colored by grief and retrospection, that the phone records established contact but not guilt. They presented Ronald Kip as a man who had, yes, been dishonest in certain respects, an uncomfortable truth they chose to acknowledge rather than deny, but who was not a murderer and who had not been at Tanya Briggs's home at the time of her death for the purposes the prosecution alleged. The jury listened. They evaluated. And after deliberating, they found Ronald James Kip guilty of first-degree murder. The verdict, when it came, carried with it all the weight that first-degree murder verdicts carry. The finding not simply that Ronald Kip had killed Tanya Briggs, but that he had done so with premeditation, with deliberation, with the kind of intent that the law reserves for its most serious consequences. The judge sentenced Kip to life in prison, a sentence that reflected both the gravity of the crime and the jury's finding about how it had been committed. Kip appealed the conviction, as is the right of every convicted defendant, and the appellate process ran its course with the seriousness that California's courts apply to capital and life imprisonment cases. The arguments raised on appeal addressed aspects of the trial, the admission of certain evidence, questions about the conduct of the proceedings, and the California appellate courts reviewed those arguments with the care the stakes demanded. The conviction was upheld. The finding of the jury was affirmed. Ronald James Kip remained, as a matter of law, guilty of the first-degree murder of Tanya Briggs, and he remained in the custody of the California Department of Corrections. There is a particular kind of grief that attaches itself to cases like this one, a grief that goes beyond the loss of the individual, though that loss is always the center, always the thing that matters most. It is the grief of a community that trusted itself to know its own members, that believed the social fabric it had woven through years of shared meals and neighborhood gatherings and genuine care for one another was something solid. Ronald Kip had lived inside that fabric, had benefited from it, had shaped it to his advantage, and he had, according to the jury that heard all of the evidence and deliberated carefully on what it meant, destroyed one of its most vital threads. Tanya Briggs had done nothing wrong. She had seen something she believed was dishonest, and she had decided to tell the truth about it because that was the kind of person she was. What her friends and family were left with, after the verdict and the sentencing and the long process of a case working its way through the courts, was the work of remembering a woman who deserved to be remembered fully, not as a victim, not as a cautionary tale, but as the generous, warm, clear-eyed person she had been every day of her life before a neighbor decided that his, the qualities that made her irreplaceable to the people who loved her, the perceptiveness, the integrity, the refusal to look away from what she knew, were the very qualities that placed her in danger. There is no comfort in that irony, only a kind of painful clarity. Reputation was worth more than hers. Ronald James Kip has remained incarcerated since his conviction. The sentence handed down by that San Diego County courtroom in 2001 has not changed. The appeals have been exhausted. The law, having done what it could, has settled into the long, quiet permanence of a closed case. For the people who knew Tanya Briggs, of course, no case is ever truly closed. The Tuesday morning when she didn't answer her door remains a dividing line in their lives, a before and after as stark and unmovable as anything can be. They carry her forward the way people carry those they have lost, in the stories they tell, in the gatherings they hold, in the small daily acts of honesty and courage that she modeled for them throughout a life that should have been so much longer. She was a good neighbor. She was a good friend. She deserved better from the man who lived next door. Our next case takes us to Coos Bay, Oregon. The call came in on a gray Tuesday morning in October of 1990, the kind of morning Coos Bay knows well. Low clouds pressed down over the water like a lid, the air thick with salt and diesel, and the particular silence that follows a storm. The Coast Guard cutter had been out for hours. What they were looking for, they had been told, was a woman. What they found, eventually, was very little. A life vest, a boat hook, a scattering of debris that could mean almost anything on a working stretch of Pacific coastline. Of the woman herself, her name was Deborah Whitaker, 34 years old, married, the mother of two children who were waiting for her at home. There was nothing at all. Her husband, Thomas Milo Whitaker, was the one who had raised the alarm. He told the Coast Guard that Deborah had gone overboard somewhere off the Oregon coast, that he had done everything he could, that the sea had simply taken her before he could bring her back. He was found aboard their commercial fishing vessel, shaken, coherent, already telling his story. The investigators who first heard that story wrote it down. They had no reason yet to doubt it. People did fall overboard off the Oregon coast. The Pacific was unforgiving that way. It happened. It just didn't always happen quite like this. Deborah Whitaker had grown up in coastal Oregon, which meant she understood the ocean the way inland people understand highways, as a fact of life, present and powerful, deserving of respect but not fear. Friends who knew her in the years before her death described a woman who was capable and warm, someone who had built her life around her family and her community with the kind of quiet determination that doesn't make headlines but holds whole households together. She had married Thomas Whitaker in the mid-1980s, and together they had entered the commercial fishing life that defines so much of the culture along that stretch of the southern Oregon coast. Coos Bay is not a glamorous place, and it has never pretended to be. It is a working town, built on timber and fishing, and the kind of labor that leaves marks on hands and faces. The people who live there are, by and large, practical people, and Deborah fit that description. She knew boats. She knew the water. She was not someone who went to sea unprepared, and the people who knew her well would say so later, when it mattered. She had children at home. She had plans. She had, by all accounts that emerged in the investigation and at trial, no reason to be careless with her life. That, as it turned out, was exactly the kind of detail that investigators would come to find significant. The timeline that Thomas Whitaker gave to authorities in those first hours after the Coast Guard located him placed the accident in the late afternoon of October 9th, 1990. He said they had been out on the water together, that Deborah had been moving around the deck, that conditions had been rough, that in a moment he could not fully explain, she was gone. He said he had searched. He said he had called out. He said he had done what any husband would do, which was everything, and that it had not been enough. The Coast Guard conducted its search and rescue operation with the thoroughness that organization brings to every call, grid patterns, aerial support, coordination with other vessels in the area. The search turned up the debris that had already been noted. It did not turn up Deborah Whitaker. In cases of drowning at sea, recovery of a body is never guaranteed, and the absence of remains, tragic as it was, did not by itself raise red flags. The Pacific had swallowed people before. It was a known outcome, a documented possibility. What began to trouble investigators, however, were the smaller things, the details that didn't quite line up, the inconsistencies that emerged not in dramatic contradiction, but in the quiet, accumulating way that truth tends to distinguish itself from a constructed story. Coos County investigators, working alongside Oregon State Police, began looking more closely at Thomas Whitaker in the days and weeks following the incident. They spoke to people who knew him and Deborah. They reviewed the couple's financial circumstances. and they discovered in short order that Thomas Whitaker had recently taken out a substantial life insurance policy on his wife. The policy had been purchased not long before her death. The beneficiary was Thomas Whitaker. That finding, documented in court records, did not prove anything by itself. People take out life insurance. It is, ordinarily, a responsible thing to do, but combined with other information investigators were gathering, it became a thread worth pulling. The investigation that unfolded over the following months was painstaking work. Oregon State Police detectives and Coos County investigators built their case the way structural engineers build a bridge. Not with a single dramatic span, but with accumulated load-bearing pieces. Each one checked and checked again before the next was added. One of the most significant contributions to the investigation came from marine forensic analysis of the vessel and the debris recovered at sea. Experts who examined the physical evidence found that the pattern of debris and the condition of certain items on the boat were inconsistent. Prosecutors would later argue in court with the accidental drowning scenario that Thomas Whitaker had described. The details of that analysis, entered into the evidentiary record, spoke to questions about where Deborah had actually been and when and under what circumstances. Witness accounts proved equally important. Investigators spoke to individuals who had contact with Thomas Whitaker in the period surrounding Deborah's death, and what those witnesses described, placed carefully against the timeline Whitaker had provided, created problems for his account. Prosecutors argued at trial that witnesses placed Whitaker in circumstances and locations that contradicted key elements of the story he had told the Coast Guard and investigators. The picture that emerged, piece by piece, was of a man whose account of that October day did not hold together under scrutiny. There was also the matter of another relationship. Investigators learned, and prosecutors would argue at trial, that Thomas Whitaker had been involved with another woman, and that this relationship represented a second motive alongside the insurance money. A desire, prosecutors contended, to be free of his marriage and free to pursue a different life. In the architecture of the prosecution's case, the two motives were described as reinforcing each other, each one making the other more comprehensible. What investigators did not have and would not have was a body. Deborah Whitaker's remains were never recovered from the Pacific. That absence posed a genuine legal challenge, because proving murder requires proving death, and proving the manner of death is considerably easier when there is a body to examine. Oregon prosecutors would need to build their case on circumstantial evidence, on the physical findings from the boat and the debris field, on the inconsistencies in the defendant's account, and on the testimony of witnesses who could speak to Whitaker's behavior and movements and the state of his marriage and finances. It was not an impossible task. Courts have convicted defendants of murder without a body before. But it required the kind of disciplined, methodical evidence gathering that leaves no easy shortcuts, and it required prosecutors willing to take the case to trial on the strength of what they had. They were. Thomas Whitaker was charged with the murder of Deborah Whitaker. The formal accusation, leveled by Coos County prosecutors and documented in Oregon State court records, alleged that he had killed his wife aboard their fishing vessel, and staged the scene to support a false account of accidental drowning. He was alleged to have done so for financial gain and to free himself for another relationship. He maintained, through his attorney, that what had happened on the water that October day was exactly what he had said it was, a terrible accident, a tragic loss, and that he was a man who had already suffered more than he could bear and was now being accused of something he did not do. The trial, held in Coos County in 1992, brought the two competing versions of events before a jury. Prosecutors presented their circumstantial case in careful sequence. The marine forensic evidence, the insurance policy and its timing, the testimony of witnesses whose accounts contradicted Whitaker's timeline, the evidence of another relationship. Defense counsel challenged each element, arguing that the prosecution was constructing a narrative from fragments that no fragment alone was sufficient, and that the absence of a body meant the absence of proof. The jury disagreed. After deliberation, Thomas Milo Whittaker was found guilty of murder. The jury's verdict, rendered in 1992 and documented in Oregon court records, reflected a finding that the totality of the evidence, no single piece of which was, perhaps, conclusive on its own, told a story that was not accidental drowning. It told a story of deliberate action and deliberate concealment. He was sentenced to prison. The case did not end there, as cases of this kind rarely do. Thomas Whittaker pursued appeals through the Oregon court system, as is his legal right, and those appeals were reviewed by the appropriate courts. The conviction, however, was upheld. The legal standing of the verdict, a finding of guilt for the murder of Deborah Whittaker, has remained intact through the post-conviction review process. He has served time in Oregon State Prison as a result of that conviction. The insurance claim, it should be noted, was never paid. The life insurance policy that prosecutors argued had been a central motive for the crime remained unpaid in the aftermath of the criminal proceeding. Whatever financial future Thomas Whittaker may have imagined for himself in the fall of 1990, it did not materialize. What lingers about this case years after the verdict is not the crime itself, but something around its edges, the geography of it, maybe, and what that geography reveals. Commercial fishing communities along the Oregon coast live with risk as a daily condition. The sea is always there, always capable of taking something away, and the people who work it understand that. They build their lives accordingly. When something is lost at sea, a piece of equipment, a catch, and yes, sometimes a person, there is a communal recognition of how fragile the margin is, how close the danger runs to ordinary life. That shared understanding is part of what makes those communities function. It is also, in a darker sense, part of what Thomas Whittaker allegedly exploited. He knew, or believed he knew, that a death at sea was a legible tragedy, one that a community would recognize and accept, one that wouldn't require much explanation because the sea itself was explanation enough. What he did not account for, it seems, were the people who would look more carefully. The investigators who would sit with the inconsistencies and refuse to let them settle. The forensic analysts who would examine the physical evidence and find that it did not match the story. The witnesses who would tell what they knew to the people asking the questions. The prosecutors who would take a case built on circumstantial evidence to trial and make it hold. Deborah Whittaker's body was never found. That is its own kind of grief, separate from everything else. The fact that her family could not lay her to rest in the conventional sense, could not complete that ritual that serves, in its small way, as a step toward healing. The Pacific coast does not always return what it takes, and in this case the sea kept its secret even after the courtroom had rendered its judgment. Her children were young when she died. Whatever they understood of their mother's death as it was first explained to them, they would come to know a different account as they grew older, the account that a jury found to be true. That knowledge is a weight. It is also, perhaps, a kind of answer, however incomplete, to what happened to their mother on that gray October morning when the clouds were low and the water was cold and the man she had trusted took her out to sea. The case of State of Oregon versus Thomas Milo Whittaker is studied today as an example of how insurance-motivated maritime homicide can be investigated and prosecuted even in the absence of a victim's remains. The tools available to investigators, marine forensic analysis, careful witness interviewing, financial record examination, timeline reconstruction, proved equal to a set of circumstances that the perpetrator appears to have believed were beyond the reach of proof. They were not. That is the thing about careful, patient investigation. It tends to find what it's looking for, eventually. The sea gave up very little. The evidence on land gave up enough. Our next case takes us to Kerrville, Texas. The needle was already in the child's arm. That is where this story begins. Not in a courtroom, not in a detective's office, but in a small clinic examination room in the Texas Hill Country, where a 15-month-old girl named Chelsea McClellan had gone limp in a way that no child should ever go limp. It was September of 1982, and the nurse attending to her moved with practiced urgency, calling for emergency transport, positioning herself at the center of the crisis she had, prosecutors would later argue, deliberately created. The little girl's mother, Patty McClellan, watched in terror as her daughter was rushed toward an ambulance. Chelsea would not survive the day, and the woman holding that needle, a licensed vocational nurse named Jenine Jones, would eventually stand at the center of one of the most deeply disturbing criminal cases in the history of American medicine. Before we go any further, we owe Chelsea McClellan more than a footnote in a crime narrative. She deserves to be seen clearly, as the people who loved her saw her. Chelsea was born in June of 1981 to Patty and Reed McClellan in the small, sun-warm town of Kerrville, Texas, nestled in the hill country west of San Antonio. By all accounts, she was a healthy, bright-eyed child, the kind of toddler who fills a house with noise and motion, who discovers the world with unguarded enthusiasm. Her parents were ordinary, hard-working Texans, the sort of family for whom a trip to the pediatrician was simply a part of keeping a child safe. That trust, the ordinary, bedrock trust that a parent places in the people wearing scrubs and carrying stethoscopes, is precisely what makes this story so difficult to absorb. Chelsea McClellan was brought to a clinic for medical care. She was 15 months old, and she had no way to protect herself from what would happen there. Neither, it turned out, did anyone else. To understand how Jenine Jones arrived in Kerrville, you have to go back a few years and a few miles to San Antonio. Jones had worked in the pediatric intensive care unit at Bexar County Medical Center, now University Hospital, through the late 1970s and into the early 1980s. She was known, by various accounts documented in subsequent reporting and legal proceedings, as an energetic, even intensely devoted nurse. She sought out the most critical patients. She was often present during emergencies. She was also, during her time there, at the center of a troubling pattern that would only be understood in retrospect. An unusual number of children in that unit deteriorated suddenly and inexplicably, often during Jones's shifts. An internal investigation at Bexar County Medical Center did flag concerns about Jones. However, in a decision that would haunt administrators for years, the hospital quietly allowed her to resign rather than formally pursuing the matter, and provided her with a reference that did not disclose the full scope of those concerns. It was a failure of institutional accountability with devastating consequences. Because Jenine Jones, armed with that reference, moved on. She arrived in Kerrville in 1982, taking a position as a licensed vocational nurse at a newly opened pediatric clinic run by Dr. Kathleen Holland, a young physician who had known Jones in San Antonio. Dr. Holland had recently established her practice and welcomed Jones's apparent experience and dedication. The clinic served the children of Kerrville and the surrounding hill country communities. Parents brought their babies and toddlers there for checkups, for vaccinations, for the ordinary business of keeping small children healthy. Almost immediately, children began having emergencies at the clinic. Between late 1981 and the summer of 1982, a remarkable and alarming number of pediatric patients experienced sudden respiratory distress or seizure-like episodes during or shortly after their clinic visits. In several cases, Jones was the attending nurse. In several cases, the children were stabilized and recovered, and Jones was visibly, almost aggressively involved in the emergency response, sometimes accompanying children in the ambulance, sometimes appearing to relish her role as the one who had spotted the crisis and acted. Then came September 17, 1982. Patty McClellan brought Chelsea in for what was described as a routine appointment. According to court records and subsequent reporting, Chelsea was given an injection by Jones. The child almost immediately began showing signs of severe distress, Her muscles went slack, her breathing faltered. An ambulance was called. Chelsea was rushed toward the hospital in San Antonio. She was pronounced dead that day. The official initial cause of death was listed as sudden infant death syndrome, SIDS, a designation that would later be challenged and ultimately overturned. But Patty McClellan, grief-stricken and struggling to understand what had happened to her daughter, could not let go of a feeling that something was wrong. She was not alone in that feeling. By the fall of 1982, Dr. Holland had begun to recognize the pattern herself. Too many children, too many emergencies, too concentrated, too consistent in their connection to a single person. She also noticed something specific and concrete. A vial of succinylcholine, a powerful muscle relaxant used in surgical and emergency settings to temporarily paralyze muscles, including the muscles needed for breathing, had gone missing from the clinic's supply. Succinylcholine, when administered without the controlled conditions of an operating room, can cause respiratory arrest. A small child given even a modest dose would stop breathing. They would be unable to cry out, unable to move. They would appear to be in sudden, unexplained medical collapse. Doctor Holland reported her concerns to the Texas Department of Human Resources, and investigators began to look more closely. They pulled records. They interviewed staff. They requested that the remaining vials of succinylcholine from the clinic be tested. What the testing revealed was remarkable. The vials had been punctured multiple times, far more than any ordinary clinical use would account for. The drug had been drawn out, repeatedly, by someone with access to the clinic's medication supply. Meanwhile, in San Antonio, a separate inquiry was quietly widening. Journalists, most notably investigative reporters whose work would eventually form the backbone of the 1984 book, The Death Shift, by Peter Elkind, had begun pressing on what had happened at Bexar County Medical Center during Jones's tenure there. The picture emerging was deeply troubling. Statistical analysis of patient deaths and emergencies suggested that children were significantly more likely to die or suffer catastrophic events during Jones's shifts than at other times. The range of children investigators eventually considered in connection with Jones's time at Bexar County Medical Center numbered in the dozens, though the precise number of victims has never been definitively established and was the subject of ongoing investigation. Texas Ranger John Allen was among the investigators who worked the Carville case. Court records and reporting document the methodical process by which investigators assembled the timeline, cross-referencing clinic appointment records, emergency call logs, ambulance records, and the medication inventory. The pattern was damning. The physical evidence from the vials was damning, and Chelsea McClellan's body was exhumed. Forensic toxicologists tested tissue samples. They found evidence consistent with succinylcholine in Chelsea's body, a finding that directly contradicted the original SIDS determination, and that would become central to the prosecution's case. Succinylcholine breaks down rapidly in the body after death. Detecting it requires specific, targeted testing. The fact that it was found, even months after Chelsea's death, was considered a significant forensic achievement. Jeanine Jones was charged in January of 1984 with the murder of Chelsea McClellan and with injury to a child in connection with a separate victim, a baby named Rolando Santos, who had nearly died at the clinic but survived. Jones's first trial for the murder of Chelsea McClellan began in Georgetown, Texas, in February of 1984. The venue had been changed from Carville due to pretrial publicity. Prosecutors argued that Jones had injected Chelsea with succinylcholine, inducing respiratory arrest, and that she had done so deliberately, not out of any mercy or misguided care, but in a pattern of behavior designed to engineer medical crises that would allow her to position herself as a skilled and heroic responder. It is a psychological profile that criminologists have since classified under the designation medical Munchausen by proxy, or, in clinical contexts, factitious disorder imposed on another. A dynamic in which a caregiver, often with some medical knowledge, induces illness in a patient to gain attention, status, or a sense of power. The prosecution presented the forensic toxicology evidence, the testimony of the medical experts who had identified succinylcholine in Chelsea's tissue, the clinic's medication records showing the punctured vials, and evidence of the broader pattern of emergencies during Jones's tenure at both Bexar County and the Kerrville Clinic. Expert witnesses testified about the drug's effects and the near impossibility that its presence in Chelsea's system could be explained by any legitimate medical treatment she had received. Jones's defense challenged the forensic evidence, questioning the reliability of the succinylcholine detection methodology and arguing that the tissue testing was subject to contamination and error. They contested the statistical arguments about the pattern of emergencies. The jury deliberated and returned a verdict of guilty of murder in the first degree. Jeanine Jones was sentenced to 99 years in prison. Several months later, in a separate trial, she was convicted of injury to a child in the case of Rolando Santos, who had been injected with heparin, a blood thinner, at the clinic, and had nearly bled to death. She received an additional 60-year sentence to run concurrently. Jones appealed her convictions repeatedly over the years that followed. Her attorneys raised challenges to the forensic evidence, to the conduct of the trials, and to various procedural matters. The Texas courts reviewed those appeals and affirmed the convictions. She was denied relief at multiple levels of the appellate process. Then came a development that many Texans and many families had not anticipated. Under a Texas law passed in the 1970s, a mandatory release statute designed to address prison overcrowding, Jones became eligible for mandatory release in 2017 when she would have served the time required under that provision. Because her convictions predated changes to Texas law that would have eliminated that eligibility for violent offenders, she was entitled to release under the terms in effect at the time of her sentencing. Her projected release date had long been a source of anguish for families who believed Jones had harmed or killed children who were never formally charged in her cases. But the legal situation changed. In 2017, as Jones's mandatory release date approached, a Kerr County grand jury indicted her on an additional charge: the murder of yet another infant, Joshua Sawyer, who had died in 1981 during Jones's tenure at Bexar County Medical Center in San Antonio. The indictment came before her scheduled release, and in 2020, Jones pleaded guilty to the murder of Joshua Sawyer and was sentenced to life in prison. That life sentence, handed down decades after her original convictions, superseded the mandatory release provision and means that Jeanine Jones, now in her 70s, will remain in prison for the remainder of her natural life. It is worth pausing here to consider what that 2020 guilty plea represents. It was not forced by new forensic technology, not triggered by a jailhouse confession, not the result of a dramatic discovery. It was the result of investigators and prosecutors who refused to let the case close, who understood that the original sentencing structure might one day allow Jones to walk free, and who worked for years to ensure that would not happen. The family of Joshua Sawyer, and the families of every child whose name appears in the margins of this case, had waited a very long time for that outcome. The question that lingers over this case, as it does over so many of the most disturbing cases in medical settings, is not simply about one individual's criminal conduct. It is about the systems that were supposed to catch her and did not. Bexar County Medical Center's internal review identified concerns about Jones' years before Chelsea McClellan was born. The decision to allow her to resign quietly, without a formal record of those concerns reaching the licensing boards or future employers, was a decision made by institutions trying to protect themselves from liability, and it cost children their lives. The nursing board was never formally notified. Dr. Holland, who hired Jones in Kerrville, did not have access to the full picture of what had happened in San Antonio. This is not an attempt to apportion blame away from Jeanine Jones. The jury found her guilty of murder. She pleaded guilty to another. The decisions she made in those examination rooms with those syringes were her own, but the conditions that allowed her to move from one setting to another, to harm children in San Antonio, resign, travel 60 miles west, and harm children again, were conditions created by a failure of accountability at the institutional level. That failure has informed, in the years since, discussions about mandatory reporting requirements for healthcare workers credentialed out of concerning situations, about the way hospitals and clinics share information, or fail to, when a staff member is let go under troubling circumstances. The case of Jeanine Jones is studied not only in true crime contexts, but in healthcare ethics and nursing education, precisely because its lessons about institutional responsibility are so costly and so clear. Chelsea McClellan was 15 months old. She had, by any account, her whole life in front of her. The hill country light that fell on Kerrville in the autumn of 1982 was the same light it has always been, warm, late, gold at the edges. She deserved to grow up in it. Her mother, Patty McClellan, never stopped asking questions. She pushed, she grieved. She insisted that her daughter's death be examined rather than filed away under a diagnosis that explained nothing. In a case built substantially on forensic science and pattern recognition, the persistent human insistence of a mother who knew something was wrong was the spark that would not go out. Jeanine Jones is serving a life sentence in the Texas Department of Criminal Justice. She is, by the reckoning of investigators and prosecutors who have studied her full history, likely responsible for far more deaths than she was ever formally charged with. The true number of her victims may never be known. What is known, what the courts have found, what the evidence has established, is enough. It is more than enough. And it is a reminder that in medicine, as in everything, the people most vulnerable to harm are those who have no choice but to trust. That's three cases for today. From all of us at Intellijix, thank you for listening. We'll see you tomorrow.